I've debated the last few days what to do with this class today, and I finally decided I want to go back to Nehemiah for just a few minutes and just finish some things up, and we're going to be done with Nehemiah and start our new study in the Gospel of John. And my plan is to work into some introductory type stuff with the Gospel of John today. But in the last portion of our worksheet on Nehemiah, there was just a couple of points I still wanted to spend a few minutes on because I just thought it stood out in some things that we needed to make some application to. And if you remember, on page 26 is where I'm looking, you know, as we were making application to some of the issues that Nehemiah had to deal with and had to work on, there was that problem with the Sabbath day where nobody was recognizing it even as a day of God, a day of worship. And so Nehemiah took some pretty drastic measures to try to influence and change the way some things were being done. And so I have thought that it's right for us to spend a few minutes to think about how that applies to us. Now, I know we don't worship on the Sabbath day. I understand we're under a different law. But there are some points that we can make application to. What those Jews had completely forgotten to do was to consider and reverence God. And that's something we can think about. And that's something that we can certainly make application to. They were thinking about, it seems, they're thinking about anything except God when the Sabbath day came around. And there were two or three passages that I got thinking about I want to share with you, and let's get some comments if you would have them, about where our minds should be come the Lord's Day. We're going to the book of Psalms. To the book of Psalms and chapter 29. And the principle that is expressed here is one that I think is helpful. The 29th Psalm. In verse 1. Ascribe to the Lord, O mighty ones. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due His name. Worship the Lord in the splendor of His holiness. It's not a surprise to us that David was the writer of this psalm, because in so many of his psalms, he is giving praise and honor to God, or he's talking about worship to God. And this psalm came to mind as I was thinking about here, let us make some application to where our minds need to be when it is a time to worship God. And I think David helps us to think about those things, that it is the Lord who is due glory. I thought that was kind of interesting. It's an interesting phrase, that it is right to give God glory. In fact, He is due this glory. And we are reminded of His splendor in holiness. I mean, we can think about the power and the might of God in all creation and all that we see, and we think of those things, and again, He's due the glory to His name. But in this passage in particular, it makes a point about His holiness. Indeed, because of His holiness, He is due glory. A couple of other psalms, the 95th Psalm. The 95th Psalm. We'll read a couple more passages, and I'll be interested to get your comments here, too. The 95th Psalm, we begin at verse 1. The 95th Psalm, verse 1. Come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout aloud to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before Him with thanksgiving and extol Him with music and song. For the Lord is the great God, the great King of all gods. In His hand are the depths of the earth, and the mountain peaks belong to Him. The sea is His, for He made it, and His hands form the dry land. Come, let us bow down in worship. Let us kneel before the Lord, our Maker. For He is our God, and we are the people of His pasture, the flock under His care. The psalmist reminds us of the power of God in all creation, and that all that we see, even in creation or in nature, are from the hands of God. And that's certainly something for us to keep in mind when we worship Him, knowing that He is the God above all gods, as this text would say. And so when we worship Him, as this would say, let us bow down in worship. Let us humble ourselves. Let us remember who we are in the presence of God. Kneel before the Lord our Maker. A reminder again of who we are in the presence of God. Now, these points in some ways are pretty simple points, aren't they? But don't we forget about them sometimes? And I keep trying to think about the scene in Jerusalem where they had just completely neglected God. They'd forgotten God. And even around the temple, this place of worship where they would come and where the priests would do their work of atonement, and though that had stopped too. You know, in the marketplace around the temple being sort of the center of some activity in the city, but not now. They'd come to a point where there was nothing going on that was spiritual or religious in nature. They'd move so far away. What can happen to us? What's the application here? What have we got to do?
It doesn't happen overnight. Something that happens very, very.
How does it happen? I mean, how can they get like that? How can we get like that? What happens?
Yes.
Well, this idea of the glory of God being seen in His creation, and it's very closely related to why we are, who we are, and why God made us. We're not made to accumulate material possessions, you know. We're not made to just enjoy the pleasures of the senses. There's a rightful place for all of those things. But we're made to glorify God. Everything else that He's created mm-hmm. glorifies Him. Mm-hmm. His creation glorifies Him. The sea and all the creatures in it glorify mm-hmm. Him. The sky and all the creatures in the sky, everything glorifies Him. And we are made to glorify God. Mm-hmm. And if we're not doing that, we're not doing our job.
It's interesting that in all creation, things happen that truly, I think, it does glorify God. The seed in the ground springs forth by the power and the nature that God has put in place. Those things just happen. We have to glorify God too, but He doesn't make us. I mean, there are other things in nature that happens just by the power of God, the way He has planned, the way He has put things in force. And we are designed to glorify God as well, but He's not going to make us. And we can see that as an example over and over as we go through the text, that God has made man in such a way that we might reach out, we might grope for Him, because He is near if we will reach out to Him. He is there for us to worship, but He's not going to make us. Now we can see time and again, even as we've gone through this story with Nehemiah, you know, what happens when they fail to look to God and fail to remember Him and the tragic consequences that come because of that is you move away from God. And then the effort to draw near to Him again through the reading of the Word and obedience to the Word, but then it went away. And how does that happen? And what is the warning to us? What have we got to take away from this?
One of the best ways for that to happen is we don't read and understand Psalms 29, Psalms 95. Honor God for who He is. Mm-hmm. We don't pay attention to His Word and forget about it.
Right. And Earl made a point here that I want to touch on again. It seems like these things don't just happen overnight. You know, that it's only over a period of time that people seem to move farther and farther away from God. There's a warning in that we need to think about here, Gene and Mector.
We have a command to meet on the first day of the week. And there are certain elements of the worship service that are outlined for us. And if we look back at Jerusalem during Nehemiah's time, they forgot to read the scriptures. They forgot to pray. They forgot to keep that day edify one another. They weren't doing that. All the lessons that we have in the New Testament that tell us how we should worship are the very things that they were not doing. Mm-hmm.
And seemingly it's a progressive, or maybe we should say it's a digressive kind of a thing. That once you stop reading the word, once you start missing the services of worship, it's so much easier to miss it again, and it gets worse and worse and worse. You know, I don't know. The text doesn't really tell us, but it's hard for me to get the impression that when things were rolling well, when Nehemiah was there, when they were worshiping, the priests were doing the job they were supposed to do, and Nehemiah left town, I have a hard time believing the next Sabbath that was all forgotten. But it took a period of time. There were steps of digression that led to where it ended up, is what I would have to think.
When I was in the Navy, my ship did a tour in the Mediterranean. And we left Jacksonville, Florida, and our first port of call was going to be Rota, Spain. When we pulled out the port in Jacksonville, the navigator's job was to get us to Rota. You know, back in the old days, they looked at the stars, mm-hmm. and they had charts, and now they had GPS or whatever. But somebody's got the responsibility of making sure that ship stays on course. Mm-hmm. If you don't pay attention to where you're going, you're going to wind up somewhere you don't want to be. And that's just to illustrate the point that we have to stay on course. And how do we stay on course? Well, each one of us has a responsibility to navigate ourselves individually. This is the chart that we go by. This is our GPS. And then those that are in leadership, preaching and teaching, they also have the responsibility to help lead folks to keep them on course. Mm-hmm. And of course, our destination is heaven. And we got to stay on course.
And there are so many things along the way that can take us off course. And if we get off course, heaven will not be our home. It was an illustration that was made a long time ago, and you know, it was Gary here. He could explain this better than I can. We got some other pilots here, too. I know that when you're flying a plane, I don't know much about it, but I do know this much, that when you're looking at the gauges that help you to set the course of where you're going, what to me might seem like, well, you're only half a degree off. We're not very far off course. Well, project that out 100 miles, and how far are you off course now? Once you've gone 100 miles, a half a degree off course, what's half a degree? That can't be much. But you're off course. And where you're going to end when you're off course is much farther than when you started off course. And can't we see that throughout the Bible text over and over again when God's people moved away? And if we think that that's not a concern to us, then we're already off course. Brent.
Summed up in 1 Chronicles 10, verse 13 and 14, it says, "So Saul died for his transgression, which he committed against the Lord, even against the word of the Lord," mm-hmm. which, what going back to what Gene said, we get away from the mm-hmm. word, we start, if we're not following the word, we're committing something against it.
Yep.
Then it says, "Which he kept not." He had it one time, but he didn't hold it to his heart, as we're told later in Luke and other places. It says, "And also for asking counsel of one that had a familiar spirit to inquire of it, and inquired not of the Lord." And so people start asking other people instead of going to God's word, what direction, instead of what should I do here? That's what happened in Nehemiah. When Nehemiah left, well, you knew it, this guy who had influence, because he was married into their family. They started listening. slay us. He's going to kill us. He's going to punish us. God is not mocked. And he turned the kingdom unto David, the son of Jesse. And that sums up Saul's life. And that's what we have done. Here's a king who God gave the privilege to be over his kingdom.
Yeah. Who once was humble before God.
And you saw what he did. What did he do? He turned away from the word of God.
Yeah. There's got to be some lessons here that we can pull out and make application to.
Right. Well, there are the common sentiments today in the denominational world that God can be served and honored apart from his word. And I think that's why you see so many different ways people worship God. Mm-hmm. Because they think that just as long as it's being offered to him, it's acceptable to him.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what we see.
Right.
We can only honor God by worshiping him and serving him according to what he has written. If we start doing what we want to do, we're not honoring him.
It's not glory to him anymore. It becomes that glory to us, you know, is what it is. I've told you this before, but it just stands out in my mind so strong. I'm going to tell you this again. And maybe you've seen this. I'm pretty sure I told you about a video clip someone sent me. Joel and Gloria Olstein. You know, about their worship, and they were both on stage at their church, and there are thousands of people there. And this little clip basically was everybody's kind of cheering, and she says, "I just want you to know and to remember that worship's not about God, it's about you." And I said, "Rewind." I went back and I listened to that, and I saw that again, and she said it again. It was exactly the same thing I heard the first time. I couldn't believe it. And everybody cheered and carried on, you know. And, I mean, I was just amazed. I mean, how bold, how crass to even think that and to preach that. And there were thousands there cheering to that.
Of course there were.
Yeah, because it's just what they want to hear.
Yeah, makes it easy for them.
It's when we start thinking about ourselves and what we want to do to in worship as opposed to what God says.
Wow.
Then you know what's right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people are just going to follow that. And so you compare that attitude, which to me is like this far extreme, to what the psalmist has said in these passages, you know, that we've read. You know, or Psalm 96, verse 8. "Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. Worship the Lord in the splendor of his holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth." I mean, the idea of trembling before God is when we remember who we are, when we are in his presence. And those thoughts can slip away so quickly and so easily. And we've seen that happen time and again throughout the Bible story. And so the whole point of the application here to us is, how are we going to make sure we don't do that? You know, what have we got to take away from this?
It's just a passage that goes with what we were just talking about. When Nadab and Abihu offered fire to the Lord, which they should not have offered. They were
right.
Authorized to offer. Here's how the Lord responded. He said, "By those who come near me, I will be treated as holy, and before all the people, I will be honored." So therefore, Aaron kept silent. He didn't complain about
that. Amazing. Impressive to me. Aaron said nothing. What could he say? But he held his peace. Bless.
If this building were a ship and we were launching out into the deep, you know, and we got away from the land, then everything would look the same. When you're way out in the ocean, everything looks the same. So the you can't tell your movement unless there's some point of reference. So when you get way out in the ocean, and we're all in this boat together, this ark, that we're, the only GPS that we can have is God's plan of service, or God's plan of salvation.
Yeah, the sermon idea is going through my mind ever since Earl brought this up. God's positioning sensor. You know.
But the thing about, I see this concept happening in the history of church and of Christianity, in that the Methodists have a boat, and the Baptists have a boat, Catholics have a boat, Presbyterians have a boat, and they can't tell because the walls are moving, the pews are moving, you know, the seats are moving, the chambers are moving, everything that is in the boat is moving together, and the people are moving. So you can't, there's no way to tell that you're moving, mm-hmm. because everything is moving with you. And that, I think that's how the denominational system that we're familiar with now has come to be, is because these different ships are moving and everything around them is moving. And the people inside mm-hmm. are moving in exactly mm-hmm. the same direction. And they can't tell that they've moved from the yeah. from the shore. From
that's
the,
right.
From, they don't
can't see how miles. Far off course you've become.
They cannot tell that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Gene?
Picking up what Les is saying, we have failed to keep the absolute truth in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
We have failed to learn from history. The very first recorded natural birth on the earth came, sinned, and we didn't learn from that.
Mm-hmm.
The people of Noah's day sinned, we didn't learn from that. Mm-hmm. The people of Israel sinned, and we didn't learn from that. Over and over, the lessons are there mm-hmm. for us, but we don't hold to the absolute truth that God gave us.
Yeah. Very true. Concerned, I would be like panicked. Concerned. We can find our way back. You know, and you know, and that's exactly what Nehemiah helped them do, was to find their way back by using the word. It's just, I'll never get over how fast they drifted away from that and the warning that provides for us. You know, we've spent a long time. Go ahead, Jean. Yeah.
And sometimes within a church, we kind of lose, if we're not teaching them, what?
Yeah.
There are other little jobs, but
right.
It's the kind of accountability process. Who's making sure that we're doing our job? Sometimes as Christian brothers and sisters, we're not really as accountable to each other
mm-hmm.
as we should be.
What a problem.
Encouraging each other.
You're right. You know, that seems to be a problem everywhere. And it's almost on one hand, I think, if there's anything that shouldn't be a problem among us, it should be that we hold each other accountable, but so often we don't.
And we're made to work.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they were physically working. Sometimes if there's a national crisis, such as 9/11, you know, we came together to pray,
mm-hmm.
but only once. Maybe mm-hmm. we should have done it a few more times.
Yeah, yeah. The opportunity is there. Good thoughts. You know, we spent a long time going through Nehemiah. I really didn't intend to take that long going through Nehemiah. But there were so many things. The more we got into it, the more I kept seeing that we had opportunity to make application. You know, and we talked about that a lot. That's where most of our discussion has taken place. We'd go through the text and we'd go through the documentary, so to speak, of the events that were happening and learn from that. But then making application to it, where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. And I hope that's been helpful. I mean, it's been good for me to go through that. I hope it's been good for you to do that. Earl?
If we study the Bible and we don't make application,
we've missed it.
That's the whole purpose.
Yeah.
To make the application.
That's right. That's right. You're right. We've missed it if we haven't done that. James.
Listening to everybody, I keep thinking about the fact that what Christ told us about the scribes and the Pharisees, and one of the things that seems to run through all the letters, and even shows up in the waning part of Revelation, is be vigilant.
Mm-hmm.
Be watchful.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something that we can do, literally it's not something we can do one day a week.
Right.
That we all have a responsibility to do every day, stay vigilant, because the world does want to overshadow us and just need to be vigilant.
And as soon as we forget that and we're not vigilant is when the world has us. Mm-hmm. That's what it does. I'd like to spend a little bit of time this morning. We've still got a few minutes left in class to start kind of transitioning our thoughts, I guess you'd say, to our next study. As you know, we're getting ready to go into the Gospel of John. And if you don't have a notebook for that already, let's see me afterwards and we'll try to make sure you have one. Because I kind of perceive that as we go forward on this, you'll have a lot of pages in that notebook. That's the plan, at least. When I first started thinking about the Gospel of John, we talked about it in a meeting, and I said, well, I think that would be good. I'd be glad to teach that, and we'll do a 3-month study of the Gospel of John. Well, it's taken us 6 months to go through Nehemiah. I'm not sure how long it's going to take us to go through the Gospel of John, but it's going to take us at least that long to go through it in any kind of a decent and thorough way. I don't want it to be a 2-year study. I'm not intending that. But it's going to take us a few months to go through 21 chapters, and so much happens in that time. We're studying the life of Christ and His ministry and His disciples. There's so many points we can make, and once again, I think there's some points of application that we should be able to latch on to. But as we get started into that, I want to just make some real introductory remarks this morning that does not even necessarily have to do just with the Gospel of John. And it's like I had said to someone here. Okay, now is that thing awake there, Lindsay? There we go. You know, I said, I want to start off with Ephesus. And I said, what's Ephesus got to do with the Gospel of John? Well, I don't know that it's even mentioned in the Gospel of John. But there's something about Ephesus that I want us to spend just a few minutes, just introductory, just to have some things in our mind. Because first, in our first lesson, we spend most of our time just talking about John. And who is he? And who is the writer of the book? We all just quickly say, well, it's John. How do you know? There's some things there we need to talk about. And so even spending a few minutes talking about Ephesus is making a presumption here that we haven't actually concluded yet. I'm getting ahead of myself some. But it just seemed a good time to go ahead and spend a few minutes on Ephesus. Why Ephesus? Because John spent a considerable amount of time in Ephesus. And so it kind of plays into the story and in the life and the times of John. And so I thought at just the beginning, spending 15 minutes or so talking about this might help us later in the study. Just looking at the map of Asia Minor and being reminded of the topography and some of the cities in Asia Minor. Of course, Israel, Jerusalem being on down the side down here by the Mediterranean Sea. On this map, we get a little bit more of a global picture of some things. And reminded of a couple of places here, well, like Ephesus is right there, Patmos. That's going to play into the life of John later on. But just trying to understand where John may have even been when he wrote the Gospel of John. And again, I am making that assumption that John was the writer of the Gospel of John. We'll talk more about that in our next lesson. But it would seem that John spent a considerable amount of time in Asia Minor here in Ephesus, perhaps spent some time there in Asia Minor with Peter and preaching throughout this area. You know, you don't read about that so much in the text. Not the Gospel of John I'm talking about, but just later in the epistles. We know a lot of the places where Paul went, and we know Paul went all through Asia Minor, making missionary trips and journeys up into that area. And what we might not think about or know is that John spent probably several more years in Ephesus than Paul did. Paul spent 3 years in Ephesus. And it would seem that the Apostle John spent many more years than that in Ephesus. Did you know that? I mean, there's a lot of things about John we don't know because we don't study John in the same way that we might study about Paul or Peter. Because in the epistles, there's so much more that is said about Paul or Peter and where they were at, and particularly Paul in his epistles. And so it's kind of interesting just to kind of stop and to think about this. Interesting that the last of the books to be written, the Revelation, was written by the pen of John, of course, led by the Spirit in Jesus. And it is said that he wrote that while on the scripture would tell us he was on the Isle of Patmos. He was banished there by the Roman government and spent, it appears to be, a number of years on the Isle of Patmos. Some say that he died on the Isle of Patmos, but then tradition holds that he came off the Isle of Patmos then and came back to Ephesus because that's where he had lived for a number of years, and that he died there in Ephesus. Of all the apostles, John is the only one that died a natural death, so far as we know. The other apostles, the other 11, we could say the other 12, if you include Judas, Judas killed himself, but then there were 11 apostles that died martyr's death. They were killed because of faith. John was not, which leads to some other interesting questions like, why not? Why wasn't he killed as the others were? And we might draw some conclusions on that as we go through our study of the Gospel of John. But it appears from all that we can find through secular history is that he died in Ephesus and was buried there. Some believe they know where he's buried. In fact, there's a tomb, you know, that is inscripted to St. John, as they would say, there in Ephesus. And so it would seem, and tradition would say, and when I say tradition, I'm going to say this a lot, we're talking about what church fathers would say. Some of the early historians of the late 1st century, 2nd, 3rd century, was that John spent considerable time in Ephesus. He was very familiar with these churches in Asia Minor. He wasn't that far away. Most likely went to those churches as well. It's interesting that in the Revelation, in chapters 2 and chapters 3, there were 7 churches written to, all in Asia Minor, all within distance of Ephesus, where John was. He knew the churches that the Lord was writing to. It was the Lord that was writing, but it was John who was penning the letter that was to be sent out to these churches. And John would have known those churches because he'd lived there for a long time. And it's not, certainly not to take anything from the influence of a letter that is coming by inspiration from the Lord, but that letter being penned by John going to those letters, wouldn't you think that would have some influence with those brethren, where he has had influence through the years? And the first letter of the 7 letters, what's the first letter he writes? To which church? Ephesus. Not really a surprise. That would be the church he was most familiar with. And so here are some things that sometimes we don't think about with regard to the Apostle John, about where he lived. Some say that he was in Jerusalem maybe up until around 40 A.D. But sometime in the 40s that he lived and worked in Ephesus and in the region of Asia Minor. Now, it would appear that during the 50s, he wasn't there. Paul was there. And I don't know if Paul and John were there at the same time. I can't think of anything that from Scripture that indicates that they were there at the same time. But we know Paul spent 3 years in Ephesus, right? And was close with those brethren. And in fact, even when he was returning from his third missionary journey, when life was starting to become shorter for Paul, hurrying to get back to Jerusalem for the Passover, he didn't have time to stop in Ephesus. But when he stopped in Miletus, who did he call for? The elders from Ephesus, right? And so, I mean, when he stopped in... Oops, come back here. When he stopped in Miletus here, and see, there were the harbor there in Ephesus was a very busy harbor. It'd be like flying in and out of Atlanta these days. It'd just be that'd be the busy airport to go through. in that whole region, the busy harbor to sail in and out of was Ephesus. If you wanted to go anywhere, you probably had to go, just like you have to go to Atlanta to go anywhere. You know, you have to go to Ephesus to get on the boat that's going to many places. He didn't stop in Ephesus. He was pressed on time. And so he came down here to Miletus, called for the elders from Ephesus, which was not that far across land over there, and the elders came to him, Acts chapter 20. And he spent time with them and warned them about some things, and they prayed together and cried together, presumably the last time they would see each other. And so all of this is just some background stuff. So when you start thinking about the Apostle John, starting to think about some places he has been and what did it look like when he was there, that's always kind of interesting in my mind to think about, you know, those things, like the harbor. I mean, the harbor outside of Ephesus is a big harbor today. Imagine how huge this would have looked when it wasn't as crowded as it would be now. You know, in the days of Paul, in the days of John. I mean, this was a major shipping area. And just some sites, you know, from around. Now, this fortress right here was not there in the first century. That was built a couple of centuries afterwards by other conquerors that came in at that time. But it's kind of a point of getting our bearings straight to think about some things. Ah, here is the harbor, way over here. And the ancient city of Ephesus is actually over here. Well, man, that's a long way from the harbor. Doesn't that seem peculiar? Because Ephesus was like a sea town. Well, how could that be? What do you think? I mean, I don't think they moved the old city of Ephesus, but what has moved? The harbor, you know, it's become perhaps filled in. I mean, I don't know that the harbor came all the way up here. I'm not saying that. But I do suspect, and some believe, that the harbor probably came more up into this valley. But over years, I mean, it's been 2,000 years, it's kind of become more filled in, and actually it's moved out some, is what some would say and believe. And so looking around the city of old city of Ephesus is St. John's Basilica. So John had his own church, someone would say. Well, that would be the case in the minds of some. But John never saw this. This was built about 550 A.D. by one of the emperors and the leaders of the time, giving honor to John, is what that was about. And of course, as we'll see here in a moment, you know, many believe that John was buried right here. In fact, his tomb would be in the middle of what was this church built, you know, centuries ago. And so when people today go to Ephesus, St. John's Basilica, or what is left of it, of course, that would be, well, that'd be a sight to go see. That would be a drawing card for what many would want to see when they go there. You know, just some points here. It's during the reign of Domitian, about 95 AD, when John was exiled to the Isle of Patmos. Now, disclaimer here. You know, when you think about the writing of the book of Revelation, there's two thoughts, primary thoughts or theories in this. One is that John was on the Isle of Patmos around 95 AD when it was written during the reign of Domitian. Then there's some, you know, very good scholars who really attribute the writing of the book of Revelation as John wrote that to before the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And there's some strong arguments that can be made on that, I understand. But again, we're just making the point here primarily that John was exiled to the island of Patmos outside in the Aegean Sea when he wrote the book of Revelation. This is still just some pictures here of St. John's Basilica, you know, as it stands today. You know, it's gone through several evolutions, as history would tell us. And you know, it was restored, and it would be conquered and tore down, or this, that, and the other. Around the 14th century, it was actually rebuilt as a mosque. You know, as the Muslims kind of controlled the area and built it as a mosque. There was an earthquake that came after that and kind of left it in the state that it's in now. And it's never been repaired after that. So this is what you would see today if you go to Ephesus today. Just some scenes around. These are our capitals, is what most would call them. These would be some of the things that would go on top of the columns you know, as we would see them. The columns, for the most part, are gone now, as often is the case. These capitals are still to be seen. And so I think we mentioned this already, is after about 40 AD, or during the 40s, when John was likely in Ephesus, and was probably there again at the last part of his life, and likely died in Ephesus. So just some pictures here of St. John's Basilica. I wonder what John would think about that. That there are some who have built a church, you know, in his honor, so to speak. Almost as though they're worshiping John. I just would like to think and hear what John would have to say about that. There's some more I want us to look at here, just in some pictures of Ephesus. But just the introductory here on some things. Now, Lord willing, Wednesday night, lesson one, the Gospel of John. Make sure you got a notebook. There's some extra handouts in back of lesson one. Work that over, because there are some thought questions there which actually require you to think some, I hope, and to make some comments so we can have discussion on Wednesday night.